From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. The best way to support the show is by booking a Disneyland, Walt Disney World, Disney Cruise Line, or Adventures by Disney Vacation with Dreams Unlimited Travel. Get a free, no-obligation quote today for your next dream vacation at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hey there, hi there, ho there, and welcome to episode 289 of Connecting with Walt. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host, executive producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Michael. How are you?
I am doing well, and we were talking off air, and I hear Rory was very successful with the Easter Bunny leaving him lots of eggs to find.
Oh, yeah. He had no shortage of eggs to find. And now we have plastic Easter eggs for life that we will never get rid of. Can't part with them at this point.
So what were in the eggs? I mean, was it candy, little toys, money? So, what did you get?
Yeah, kind of all over the place. Some were little candies, like little Tootsie Rolls. And then others were, little small like trinkets and toys. So I'm actually impressed at all the variety of Easter eggs that he was able to find. I just thought they were all going to be completely empty, and it was just a life lesson in being able to find what you can't see necessarily. But no, there was actually a prize to it, so that was a nice surprise.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's what they do in our neighborhood when they have Easter egg hunts. It's all plastic eggs with little candies and prizes and
Next
stickers
time
and things.
I'm
like
gonna
that
try to ask the Easter Bunny if they can think about cash. We don't want change because that's still dangerous for little kids. But it was some ones, some fives, that wouldn't hurt.
When all the cousins were little, and we would have, and my brother-in-law, Carol's brother, always hosted Easter. So when all the kids were little, of course there'd be an Easter egg hunt, and my mother-in-law would bring over eggs. They had money in them.
Yeah. I always love when there's the money surprise aspect with it. It was the same thing with like Halloween. It's like if you found someone giving away money or the candy bar, the full size candy bar, it was always extra special. But money is just like it's the gift that keeps on giving.
And I think I must have been the only parent who are the Easter Bunny. Our children would, of course, color eggs. I'd color them with them a couple of days in advance, and so it. Carol would join in as well. And then we would sort of leave them out for the bunny. And then he would hide our real colored eggs. And then we would find them. Well, the kids would find them. So we never used plastic eggs except in their Easter baskets.
Yeah. When we would make eggs, my mom, she would color them with us and we'd have fun doing that. But then those ended up being the eggs that she would use for deviled eggs.
Egg salad.
Yeah. Yep. So we never really had time to do it because, we'd either be prepping to go to Ohio or we'd be hosting people over at our house. So the time that we actually had with our eggs that were a different color were, it was very minimal, but, we always love doing it, and she would always save usually one or two that we could look at in the refrigerator that didn't get used. But she was very good about making sure that if we were using the eggs for a purpose, then they actually had to be used beyond just coloring them.
Oh, ours became egg salad and stuff. So
yeah, I can't even. Kylie and I tried to color eggs one year, and she was like, "Can we just like." Not, and you can just make deviled eggs right now. Okay, fair enough.
Well, you'll have fun with Rory when he's old enough to color eggs.
As long as we can convince mom to hold off on the deviled eggs long enough.
Oh, well, we want to remind folks that that we have cut off as of the date this show's released, submitting questions for the Q&A show.
Yes, we have. So no more time to ask questions. If you have a question that you feel like is going to break the entire world and internet and it must be asked on this round, go ahead and send either Michael or myself an email. Our emails are michaelbowling@disneyinfo.com or craig@disneyinfo.com. But beyond that, if you leave any questions on the Facebook group, we're not going to see them at this point, and in Twitter. So, you know, there's always going to be another round of question and answers probably towards the end of the summer. So if you have a question that's not pressing, you know, maybe save it for that. But if you have one that's like really, really good and deals with something that's been happening with the company lately, you know, you can always send us a last second one. We'll see if we can get it in there.
Yeah, there's been a lot happening with the company lately, that's for sure.
Honestly, the day that we're recording this, it's been a morning filled with news that we're not even going to get into on this episode.
I haven't even heard any. I haven't heard the news today. So
yeah, I'm sure you'll see it later, but I don't know if you saw the tease, but yesterday, as of the time of recording this, they teased that there's going to be a new YouTube series taking you behind Imagineering. They released the first episode this morning, and it showed off the Tiana's Bayou Adventure animatronics that look incredible. But not only that, but they also have basically said that Tropical Americas is definitely happening at Animal Kingdom. It's still blue sky in terms of what they could do, but they've already done their research trip to the regions, and they're moving forward with it. So it's been an exciting week. And then of course, also yesterday was the board vote. So,
I thought we'd talk about that at the end. I want to get your thoughts and what you think is going on, but let's talk about it at the end. I'm curious why do you think they released the Imagineering series on YouTube rather than Disney Plus?
Do you want me to answer it now or wait till the end?
Oh, it's up to you.
We're thinking about it right now, so I know we'll still get in the board at the end. So I'll answer this. I know that social strategy is really big right now with Disney. It's something that they want to focus on, and YouTube is not a platform, in my opinion, and I think Disney's opinion, that they've taken a lot of advantage of, especially in terms of more shorter form videos. Like this Imagineering video is only 13 minutes. Does that have a home on Disney Plus? Absolutely, I think it has a home, but I'm not sure if it's necessarily where they want to get most of the eyes on it. I think the people that they are targeting with it is that crowd that goes on YouTube and social media more than the general masses with Disney Plus. And I think, you know, beyond the inspiration for these series being like classic episodes of the Disneyland television series with Walt taking you behind the scenes into what the Imagineers were cooking up, I think it also is taking inspiration from the Imagineering story from Leslie Iwerks. And I think it's combining all of that. But I think that YouTube is also a platform that keeps it free for everyone to get excited about what Imagineering is doing versus making them pay to get excited about what's coming up. So I think it makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons, but I think ultimately it's going to open up and expose Imagineering to a much bigger crowd than was previously open to Imagineers. And it's going to start giving more of the Imagineers a voice. In the same way too, and you know, I think they really want to get away from that kind of gray period between Joe Rohde and to now, where you know maybe we only know a couple Imagineers at this point. You know, Bruce Vaughn, we know I mean, I guess he's kind of the biggest one right now in that sense. And then beyond that, we had Zach Ridley for a while with the Epcot project. But there's so many Imagineers that just aren't really discussed right now that they want to get out there and start really telling their stories. So I think that's why they're going that route with it. facts, and a little bit of it is inside knowledge. And then beyond that, it's just my, you know, my reasoning for why I would put it on there rather than Disney Plus. I don't think some stories should be hidden behind a paywall. And this is one story that I don't think they should. And I love it. I love that they want to try to regain that same spirit and energy that Walt originally used when promoting the parks before they were open. Like, it's
good. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And is it, is it edited more like Leslie Iwerks' Imagineering story than that other series?
No, it's closer to like the one day at Disney. It's still marketing. It's not, I don't think it's as aggressive.
Quick editing and that annoying narrator.
No. You're talking
humor and.
Yeah, you're talking the Dwayne Johnson series, the behind the attractions. I feel like it's in between. No, leave that to the side. That's completely different. I feel like this is kind of a mix between the one day at Disney short series that they did on all the Disney employees, and then the Imagineering story. It's kind of like a blend of the two together. It's the first episode they released is well produced, and like I said, it's getting to see the Tiana's Bayou Adventure animatronics. These things, if they don't get you excited for this attraction, all the naysayers that have been saying, you know, there's going to be barely any animatronics or they're going to not be great, they are rolling everything out for this attraction to make you forget about what the topic of today's show is.
That's right. So that was a perfect lead-in, Craig, actually, because with the anticipation of Tiana's Bayou Adventure opening at the Magic Kingdom and Walt Disney World and Disneyland, and with Disneyland also seeing expansion of New Orleans Square theming into Critter Country and the New Orleans theme being introduced in Frontierland at the Magic Kingdom, we thought that on this zippity-doo-dah kind of day, we would look into the history of the attraction Tiana is reimagining, Splash Mountain. So our exploration of Chicopin Hill and its critters begins on December 9th, 1845, when Joel Chandler Harris was born in Eatonton, Georgia. Joel's father abandoned his family shortly after he was born, so his mother, Mary, was befriended by Dr. Andrew Reed, who gave them a small cottage to live in behind his mansion. Mary took in sewing and helped neighbors with their gardening, and she also homeschooled Joel until he reached school age. Dr. Reed paid his tuition to attend school. His teachers reported that Joel had an excellent memory and writing ability. He also had a love of books and reading newspapers. When he turned 16, Joel got a job setting type for a newspaper, The Countryman, on the Turnbull Plantation, which was owned by Joseph Addison Turner. It was Turner's goal to cultivate corn, cotton, and literature. Turner became a surrogate father to Joel and recommended books for him to read from his personal library to expand his liberal arts education to include Edgar Allan Poe, Henry Timrod, Charles Dickens, and Shakespeare. Joel published 30 poems and book reviews for The Countryman and several comic paragraphs with the byline The Countryman's Devil. Joel spent his free time in the slave quarters and the kitchen, listening to Uncle George Terrell and Aunt Chrissy and Old Harbert and other enslaved people tell animal folk tales in a distinct dialect. The slaves had grown up with these stories in the Caribbean and Africa and adapted them for their American environment. For example, the fox replaced the hyena as one of the main characters in the stories because there were no hyenas in the United States. These enslaved people would be the models for Uncle Remus, Aunt Tempe, and other characters in the African-American animal tales Joel would write years later. In 1864, during his march to the sea, General William T. Sherman and his forces ransacked Turnbull Plantation. The destruction and looting caused Turner to shut down the plantation. Joel Chandler Harris, now a published author, took on editor positions with a couple of newspapers before working at the Atlanta Constitution in September 1876. He wrote articles about the songs, stories, and Southern adages he had heard during his time at the Turnwold Plantation from the perspective of a fictional character named Uncle Remus. He would go on to publish 35 books, which included several collections of Uncle Remus tales, and became one of the most famous American authors of the time, second only to Mark Twain. I had no idea when I was reading about him how popular he was. They say that he was an inspiration for Beatrix Potter and her delightful and charming stories of animals. And Rudyard Kipling was also a huge admirer of Joel Chandler Harris.
Yeah, I will be completely transparent. We did not read any of those stories when we were growing up in Pennsylvania. That was something that I wasn't even aware of. I mean, Beatrix Potter, absolutely, but mm-hmm. even with Kipling, you know, we knew Jungle Book from the movie, not from any of the texts, but definitely anything, the Tales of Uncle Remus, I didn't know anything about it, so much that when I think it had to be around like 96 when I finally kind of realized in my brain, like, okay, Splash Mountain has to be based on something. What's it based on? And then what's that based on? And that's about the point where I finally figured out. So it's always wild to hear how popular it was considering in our spot of the country in the time that I grew up, it was non-existent completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I was growing up, I did read some of the Uncle Remus stories, but I don't know if it was like full books that they were actually Joe Chandler Harris books, or because in the 50s and 60s, it was really common to have like compilation books that would have children's stories that were, you know, they pulled different authors' stories and combined them in books. So that,
yeah.
And I think that's what I had. And so I think some of the Uncle Remus stories were included in there. So what I didn't get was like, he wrote like Tales of the Plantation and he wrote things like that. Because remember, he was writing originally during the, you know, in the South during the Civil War. So yeah. They say a lot of his stories sort of romanticized the South during that era and was very sympathetic to the Southern cause.
Yeah.
So, which would lead to controversy later on that we'll get into.
Exactly. So I know, just like to give the opposite perspective, that my wife's family, you know, she grew up in Atlanta and they had at least a copy of the Uncle Remus stories. So for the South, apparently, even when I was growing up, that was a thing that was still kind of commonplace there. But in the North, not at all.
Yeah. And I remember when I read like about Prayer Rabbit, Prayer Bear, I even though I had read Mark Twain, you know, because in my day, you know, you always read Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, stuff like that. I had a really hard time with the dialect in the Uncle Remus stories, just getting through it. And so I think that I don't know. So I didn't find the Uncle Remus stories as compelling. I found them interesting, but they didn't pull me in. And I think it was just I couldn't get through the dialect.
Yeah, I've never read them. I haven't dug into it. Like, I was interested when I was a kid and finally found out what Splash Mountain was based on in the stories. And I can remember once going to like Barnes & Noble or Walden Books to be like, okay, well, do they have this there? And it wasn't even sold or available mm-hmm. where we were from. So it was one of those things. I never read it at that point. And then as time went on, it was just something that I didn't really care to read. And I still don't really have a passion to look into, but that's my side of it. There's also plenty of historical books that I have zero passion to ever read. I have a a long line of books that I really want to read that I know I'm never going to get to, let alone the stuff that I don't want to experience.
Yeah. Well, as a boy, Walt Disney read the Uncle Remus stories, in which Uncle Remus would tell the complex allegorical tales, first to a little boy on the plantation, and in later books, to the son of the little boy, who is sent by Miss Sally, his grandmother, to hear Uncle Remus's stories and learn how to be a real boy, because this little boy was sort of frail and timid in the stories. Walt would later write, "Ever since I had anything to do with making motion pictures, I have wanted to bring the Uncle Remus tales of Joel Chandler Harris to the screen." After the success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the studio purchased or attempted to purchase the rights to several properties for possible future films. This included Peter Pan, Wizard of Oz, and the Uncle Remus stories. Walt ordered two research reports to be prepared by the studio in 1938 on the background of the stories themselves, and the feasibility of making the stories into a film. In 1939, the studio negotiated with the Harris family for the film rights to the stories and paid the family $10,000, which was a significant sum at the time. The family had long hoped the Walt Disney Studio would bring these stories to life and were enthusiastic about a possible film. On November 12, 1946, Walt Disney released Song of the South. The movie tells the story of a white woman named Sally and her son Johnny, who go stay with Sally's mother on her plantation in post-Civil War Georgia. During his visit, Johnny befriends Uncle Remus, played by James Baskett, an African-American man living and working on the plantation. Uncle Remus offers Johnny a series of life lessons, which Song of the South brings to life with animated sequences featuring Br'er Bear, Br'er Fox, and Br'er Rabbit. The film opened to mixed reviews and controversy that we will discuss when we explore the history of Song of the South in a future episode in our Disney film series. The main controversy over Song of the South is its romanticized portrayal of the time period depicted in the film. Although films like 1915's Birth of a Nation, 1939's Gone with the Wind, 1935's The Little Colonel, and The Littlest Rebel depict the same time period with even more inaccuracies, they are still available to audiences. However, Song of the South has not been legally available in the United States since 1986. My purpose in bringing this up is not to argue the merits of the Walt Disney Company permanently locking up Song of the South in a Disney vault. I bring this up because it will have an effect on the history of the Disney park's attraction that is based on the stories depicted in the film. We now jump forward to Disneyland in the 1970s. After a significant expansion to the park in the 1960s, with attractions like Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln in New Orleans Square, with Pirates of the Caribbean and the Haunted Mansion, Disneyland would add several more attractions to the park. Bear Country opened in 1972, replacing the Indian Village and removing that section of the park from Frontierland. Bear Country included the Country Bear Jamboree, Davy Crockett's Explorer Canoes, the Mile-Long Bar, and Teddy Bear's Swinging Arcade.
I never thought about it, but I guess the Explorer Canoes technically would be part of that part, because it's kind of past New Orleans Square, and it's well past Frontierland. But that's just one of those things. I never realized that. It just always kind of existed as its own thing right down there. But
it's
Bear Country.
It's one of those trivia questions at Disneyland. What attractions, moved lands but never moved?
Yeah.
The Matterhorn is one because it was in Fantasyland, Tomorrowland, Fantasyland again. Davy Crockett's Explorer Canoes is another one.
There you go. I will remember it for the next trivia.
Yeah. Also introduced the same year was the Disneyland Main Street Electrical Parade. You know, I'm thinking, look what Disneyland added in the 60s and 70s. And now we go through so many years without an attraction. And now what they're doing is, instead of adding capacity, they're refurbishing or reimagining existing attractions.
Yeah, I mean, they did add capacity with Runaway Railway.
That's
and that
true.
Was a big one. Mm-hmm. But you are correct that more often than not, you know, it definitely is taken away. And yeah, I mean, I can even make the argument too for Galaxy's Edge. They lost a little bit there, but added a lot coming with it too. I think also the problem is that it's just, back then it was Disneyland that they had to worry about, and now they have multiple parks and resorts across the entire globe, and and sometimes they get so focused on spreading the love that you forget about, you know, making these small little additions to the parks as the years go on. And, you know, I feel like Walt Disney World has gotten a lot of love in terms of adding versus just replacing, but you know, it's tough, and who knows? So Disneyland might be adding a whole lot extra very soon. So,
well, very soon, that maybe that's debatable, but
yeah,
they're talking about it. In 1973, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln was converted to the Walt Disney Story to honor Walt Disney, since he had passed a few years earlier. To replace the Carousel of Progress in Tomorrowland that had been transported to the Magic Kingdom at Walt Disney World for its 1971 opening, America Sings opened in the Revolving Theater Building in 1974 to celebrate the United States Bicentennial, occurring in 1976. Mark Davis, who was known for creating large panoramic audio animatronic scenes for attractions like the Jungle Cruise, Pirates of the Caribbean, Haunted Mansion, and the Country Bear Jamboree, was assigned to work on this patriotic show that would retain the same format of a rotating stage, with six different stages divided by walls. The show, hosted by Sam the Eagle and Ollie the Owl, depicted the history of music in the United States. Although guests questioned why the show was in Tomorrowland, it was extremely popular. As the Bicentennial came and went, the attraction became less and less relevant to guests. Attendance shrank, and maintenance on the attraction was reduced. The Critters and America Sings sang their last round on April 10th, 1988. Now, have you heard like the soundtrack for this attraction?
I have, and I'm kind of sad that I never got to experience it, because I've always been impressed, and I've seen a little bit of video here and there of it, like bad quality video, but I've tried to look at different perspectives of it. The hilarious thing is, I feel like in this day and age, there'd be people standing up saluting it at this point. So if only it could have held out a little longer, it could still be thriving at Disneyland today.
And I think they would have somehow incorporated like soul into it or something. I don't know how, but because there was a jazz, little segment in there.
Yeah.
It was a delightful show, but it did outlive its time. But it was so cute when, you know, the little critter, the weasel would come and say, "Pop goes the weasel." And then, but people would clap as, as it rotated. And all that is as Sam the Eagle would sing the little connective song as we rotated to the next scene and all that. So in its heyday, this was delightful. It was so much fun. Really enjoyed it. I listen to the soundtrack every so often.
It's that's where I sometimes question, it's like, how come some attractions don't get that lifespan? And then there's others that I feel like, you know, that have overstayed their welcome and don't have any plans of ever going anywhere at any time. And I'm talking specifically about Monsters Inc. Laughlore, that has overstayed its welcome by probably 10 years at this point, but still thriving.
Yeah. Yeah. Carol loved that attraction though. I don't know why.
We could make an entire episode on the list of attractions we don't understand why they're still around and people love them. And we'll never find the answers.
Well, the park now had over 100 out-of-work audio animatronic figures to deal with. Two of the singing geese are stripped down of their metal frame and repurposed as G2 droids for the Star Tours queue. The Rattle and Roll Stork was used as a demonstration figure for new Imagineers to learn and experiment with. The rest quietly resided in the shuttered Carousel Show building. During this era, Walt Disney Productions experienced an internal upheaval with the removal of Ron Miller and hiring of Michael Eisner and Frank Wells to head the company. One of Michael Eisner's goals was to increase park revenue, and one of the ways to do this was to invest heavily in expanding the parks and resorts. Imagineering dusted off several projects under development that had been shelved due to budget cuts. Water flume rides were all the rage in the theme park industry in the 1980s, and Disneyland didn't have one. Dick Nunes, chairman of the Disney theme parks, had been pressuring the Imagineers to come up with an idea for one because a water-based thrill attraction was consistently at the top of guest requests for Disneyland. Ideas for a raft river attraction and a log flume ride were being considered. At the same time, Bear Country was having a problem. Sitting at the far edge of the park, guests were not walking the distance to see Country Bear Jamboree. Compounding the problem was that two theaters had been built for the bears, and they were no longer filling both theaters to capacity. Frequently, one theater would be closed, so the attraction was considered to be underperforming. Nunes wanted something in that area of the park that would attract more guests to Bear Country. I always say that was one of the reasons Country Bear Jamboree was shuttered, because they built two theaters. If they had built one, I think it would still be there.
Yeah, probably. And it's tough, though, because there's plenty of examples over the years where you're like, okay, if this would have just had more capacity, you know, maybe it would have been a better guest experience. Maybe it could have helped. But I feel like more often than not, there's just some attractions, specifically shows, that are built with too much capacity to handle the immediate crowds, and not realizing that everything does have a life, that, you know, eventually it's going to get lesser and lesser as the years go on. And that's when things always make it look even worse. So it's just sometimes you want to be there to tell them, like, just deal with the fact that the crowds are going to be angry and agitated, that they have to wait a long time in the beginning. But as it moves on, the demand for it will lessen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A Hatfield and McCoy-style bear shootout log flume attraction was being pitched. I can't even imagine what that was. Tony Baxter, the creative lead for Disneyland, was not excited about the idea. The other challenge was, where could the attraction work thematically, and where did they have the space? Tom Morris suggested a few areas, including the space where the Fantasyland Theater is today, and where the Big Thunder Ranch was, before they settled on the entrance to Bear Country. Imagineers wanted this attraction to be longer, taller, and better than the Timber Mountain log ride at Knott's Berry Farm. As the story goes, stuck in traffic on the Santa Ana Freeway, Tony Baxter got to thinking about America Sings, that was about to close, how Dick Nunes wanted a water flume attraction, and the need for another attraction in Bear Country to attract more guests to that area of the park. Then inspiration struck. When Baxter was younger, he saw Song of the South during its re-release to theaters. Recalling that most of the animated sequences were full of cute animal characters, those animals could be pulled from the film and placed into a different story medium. Remember, this was before social media and streaming services. Since Song of the South had not been released to home video, few were aware of the film. Placing the animated characters from the film into an attraction would be the perfect way to reimagine the IP. This would be a cost-effective and smooth transition from America Sings to a new attraction for the audio animatronic figures. Mark Davis was tasked with working on the show scenes for the new attraction since he had worked on Song of the South and designed the characters for America Sings. So the Imagineers could reuse most of the figures because they looked like they belonged in the same world. So after his inspirational commute to his office, Tony Baxter met with co-workers, which were show producer Bruce Gordon and project designer John Stone, to brainstorm ideas for the attraction. After a few days, they had a fairly complete concept for the attraction, the Zippity River Run. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Development on the attraction continued as storyboards were completed and a detailed model of the attraction was constructed by John Stone and Chris Teets. Now they had to pitch the idea to the new CEO, Michael Eisner, and President Frank Wells. The meeting was set for a Saturday, and Marty Sklar and his Imagineers were prepared to pitch several attraction ideas, including the Zippity River Run. Eisner brought his 14-year-old son, Breck, along to see his reaction to the attraction concepts, since Eisner wanted to attract more teenagers and young adults to the parks. During the presentation, Bruce Gordon said, "What makes Disneyland special is we put a mythology around our attractions. Pirates has pirates. Mansion has ghosts. If you go to Magic Mountain, it is just an iron ride. You ride a roller coaster. It's a fun coaster, but it's still just a coaster. Disneyland tries to take it one step further. Once we had the biggest and best log ride, we decided to lay mythology on the top of that. Go back to one of the best Disney has ever appropriated. The Joel Chandler Harris Uncle Remus characters, Br'er Rabbit, Br'er Bear, Br'er Fox from the 1946 classic Song of the South. The animation from this, the characters, backgrounds, music is some of the best stuff we've ever done. We've never used this stuff in an attraction before. We decided, let's take all the characters from Song of the South and follow the adventures of Br'er Rabbit." Breck was so excited about the Zippity River Run model that Eisner greenlit it, with some exceptions. Firstly, there would be no reference to Uncle Remus, which is how Br'er Frog, the pipe-smoking frog who fished alongside Uncle Remus in the film, became the narrator of the attraction. Secondly, both Eisner and his son disliked the name, the Zippity River Run. The studio just had a hit with their live-action film Splash, starring Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah. To capitalize on the film's success, Eisner wanted a mermaid added to the attraction, and its name changed to Splash. Talk about synergy.
Yeah, I mean, it's synergy is still an important concept to this day. I don't know if it was just Splash, if it would have been as well, but who knows? Yeah, that's what most people just shorten it to anyways. Just, you want to go ride Splash? So,
and he wanted the mermaid to look like Daryl Hannah also.
I mean, it's. I felt like she made a good mermaid.
She did. Yeah. Now, Sklar and the Imagineers were able to convince Eisner that this was not a good idea. I also read in other accounts that they just ignored him. So, but he relented, but still insisted the name be changed because he and Breck were convinced that the Zippity River Run name would not appeal to teenagers.
Yeah, it doesn't flow at all, and it, like, I don't know. It seems like almost the name for a rapids ride versus maybe that's because of Grizzly River Run that pops into my head, but it just it feels more rapids than it does log flume.
Yeah. So I just wonder, you know, people would have shortened this name somehow if it had been named this. I wonder what they would have called it.
Probably just River Run. Honestly, yeah. I think that's what they would have changed it to.
Yeah. It was then suggested to add Mountain to Splash, Everyone then knew the name Splash Mountain would be a hit and add to the Disney Mountain range of the Matterhorn, Space Mountain, and Big Thunder Mountain. The design and construction planning soon began in April 1987 and was planned to open in 1988. A separate model was made for each of the 15 scenes in the attraction. Nine of those scenes featured audio animatronic characters, including the old mill, the bog, the swimming hole, the rabbit hutch, the hollows, the laughing place, the burrows, Brer Fox's lair, and the showboat finale. The Zip-a-Dee Lady's showboat was the largest animated prop at the time, a 50 feet wide and 30 feet high. Imagineer and Disney legend Bob Gurr helped design the showboat. The final drop into the Briar Patch is about 52.5 feet, the longest drop at the time, and the logs reach a top speed of 40 miles per hour. The attraction quickly exceeded its budget of $75 million. Now, Splash Mountain would be the first attraction outside of Fantasyland based on a Disney animated film. Even though the goal was to remake the characters as Disneyland characters and mascots rather than references to Song of the South. As we will learn, this was wishful thinking. It was very important that the exterior of the attraction blend in with its surroundings, such as New Orleans Square and Bear Country. Since it was based on animated characters, it was determined that guests should only see the cartoon world inside the attraction and not on the exterior. Additionally, the structure could not rise too high over its closest attractions, like the Haunted Mansion and Country Bear Jamboree, nor be taller than Sleeping Beauty Castle and the Matterhorn. So the foundation for the attraction was sunk deep in the ground. In 1988, Bear Country was renamed Critter Country to fit in with the theme of the coming new attraction. The opening of Splash Mountain was delayed for several reasons. Other projects like Star Tours and Captain EO took priority over Splash Mountain. And the engineers had to resolve some issues with the project. One problem occurred when test riders became soaked by the splashing water rather than a light, pleasant sprinkling. The solution was a redesign of the boat configuration, reducing capacity from 8 riders to 7 in order to lighten the overall weight, along with structural changes that changed the underside of the ride vehicle. The angle of the final plunge was built at 47 degrees, but was supposed to be built at 45 degrees. This was corrected during the 2018 refurbishment of the attraction. However, some reports state the drop was rebuilt before the attraction was open, which added to the delay of its opening. But there are no construction photos from this time showing the drop being rebuilt before its official opening. Another problem that arose had to do with the reuse of the audio animatronic figures from America Sings. Baxter Gordon and other Imagineers reportedly added them everywhere, which created a hard-to-understand storyline. After many of the figures were installed, Bruce Gordon brought David Fighton in to get his advice on how best to fix it. Fighton removed some figures and moved others to improve some of the staging, and he removed some audio tracks. Fighton also reprogrammed the audio animatronics.
I'll tell you what. I mean, even knowing this now, I still don't know if they succeeded by removing some of the animatronics, because at Disneyland, at least, it was always just a blur of this is over here and this is over there, and it's fast, and there's clearly music trying to keep it all together. But the story was much better presented at Walt Disney World mm-hmm. than it was at Disneyland. Just too much and all too quickly.
But that's what I liked about the Disneyland version is there were so many critters just everywhere. It felt like it was really alive with little critters.
Yeah, I'll give it that. It's more just hard from a perspective of, like, what do you look at? Which I guess that adds to the rewritability of it at the time, but it just almost felt like too much versus when you're, you know, when you're on an Omni Mover attraction that's telling you this is what you need to look at, and or even Pirates with the way that they kind of segment the show scenes to be like, yeah, this is what's important, but there is still theming over on this side. With Splash Mountain is like you could choose anywhere and at Disneyland, and you could pretty much still luck out on being entertained.
Yeah. Well, and that was true. That was the Imagineering, I think, sort of philosophy at the time. Because look at It's a Small World as well. It is packed with dolls and toys and things. Very different, I think, from the Magic Kingdom version.
Yeah.
Where it is more scenes.
Exactly.
And that's where, and like you said, when we first brought that up, I immediately thought of what Walt said about like Pirates of the Caribbean. Every time you ride it, you'll see something new. Haunted Mansion is the same way. And I do think that was the philosophy for Splash Mountain. Yeah. Every time you ride it, you're going to see something new and different in there as you speed by.
As you speed by. That's the key word, as you speed by.
Yes. So Josh Stone, Bruce Gordon, and Tony Baxter wrote new lyrics for the songs in the attraction. Nick Stewart, who was over 70 years old at the time, was brought back to voice Br'er Bear for the attraction, just as he had done in the film. Jess Harnell was hired as the speaking and singing voice of Br'er Rabbit and a few other critters. The snoring heard in the cave just before you enter the interior portion of the attraction was originally attributed to the country bear Rufus on the attraction, who had once been heard as you entered Bear Country. It was later changed to be Br'er Bear snoring. There is a backstory that the Imagineers gave Splash Mountain, and this story is more evident in the Tokyo Disneyland version of the attraction. But legend has it that deep in the new United States of Georgia live critters that walk and talk in the same manner as human folk. At the center of this magical land is Chickapin Hill, and it's here that the Beaver Brothers had built their sturdy new dam. But unbeknownst to them, Rackety Raccoon had also constructed a juice-producing still in the same area. And it seems that while Rackety was concocting a new experimental brew, he used a few too many blueberries with disastrous results. When his still exploded, it took the Beaver Brothers dam with it, and water began to rush downhill through the many caves, burrows, holes, and tunnels that crisscrossed the mountain. From that moment on, the local critters started calling their home Splash Mountain, and the name stuck.
Well, I'll say this much. When people are complaining about Tiana's Bayou Adventure and the amount of backstory that they're putting into that, at least you can't say that there wasn't a precedent already set for it with Splash Mountain. Oh, I don't think in either case they were necessary. This story is ridiculous, but always happy to learn what the actual story is behind these attractions.
I love hearing these backstories. That's one of the fun things of doing this show and digging into the history of the attractions is hearing these backstories. Yeah.
This one's on the crazy side, though, and I'm not sure how to feel about United States of Georgia. But you know what? Doesn't matter anymore.
Got to consider the era.
Yeah.
But this is why at Tokyo Disneyland, Rackety's Raccoon Saloon is located outside the exit of the attraction, and guests could paddle around Tom Sawyer Island on the Beaver Brothers canoes. In 1988, Stone shared the storyline of the attraction. Our moral, similar to that of the Wizard of Oz, is that you're looking for adventure. The best place to find it is in your own backyard. The story in a nutshell involves Br'er Rabbit's laughing place. Br'er Rabbit gets caught by Br'er Fox and tossed in the Briar Patch along with us, and finds out in the grand finale that the Briar Patch is where he was born and bred. We really selected the best elements of the film to tell the story of our attraction. Tony, Bruce Gordon, and myself literally spent 3 days in Tony's office preparing about 30 storyboards and outlining the entire project. The ride was originally called Zippity River Run. Then it was called the Song of the South Log Flume Ride. It was Eisner who said, it's a mountain. There's a big splash at the end. It's Splash Mountain. Earlier, I mentioned that the closing of America Sings had been planned prior to the concept of Splash Mountain due to its decline in guest attendance. In later years, Alice Davis attributed cost overruns on Splash Mountain as the reason behind the closing of America Sings and its figures being used to reduce the costs of Splash Mountain. But this does not appear to be the case, since the initial storyboards for Splash Mountain show the America Sings figures. Besides the addition of Splash Mountain, Fowler's Harbor was completely rebuilt to add the harbor galley and make the area accessible to guests. The mile-long bar refreshment center was converted to the Brer Bar and the Golden Bear Lodge into the Hungry Bear Restaurant. Teddy Barr's swinging arcade became Pooh Corner. After 5 years, it included 80 hours of reprogramming every figure and 3 months to rewire them, 950,000 gallons of water, and $85 million, Splash Mountain was ready for its official opening on the 34th anniversary of Disneyland, July 17, 1989. Actor Jim Varney, who is popularly known as Ernest, and 12 celebrity children joined Michael Eisner, Brer Rabbit, Brer Fox, and Mickey Mouse in turning on the water pump to create a big splash. It was an immediate hit, and attendance significantly increased at Disneyland. Michael Eisner soon approved a version of Splash Mountain for the Magic Kingdom at Walt Disney World, and the Oriental Land Company requested a version for Tokyo Disneyland. These would be redesigned versions to better fit in with their parks. A version of Splash Mountain was planned for Disneyland Paris, but was dropped for budget reasons and the cold weather. The attraction has never been discussed for Hong Kong Disneyland or Shanghai Disneyland.
I honestly feel like the parks that were chosen, I've never been to Tokyo Disneyland, so I can't really comment on that one, but I can't imagine it being at Disneyland Paris. Like, I can't even picture a point that it would fit in with that park because of how unique it is. It kind of worked in all the other parks because of its position in the parks, and the only place I could picture it in Disneyland Paris would be where Phantom Manor is. And that kind of would disrupt that entire flow.
Yeah, it would be in that area of the park, definitely. Yeah. But somewhere.
Yeah, but, better to leave it not there.
Yeah, and Tokyo makes sense because they do have warm summers. Boy, I was there once. The last time I was there, it was hot and humid.
I feel like, though, that the excuse with Paris of just cold weather, I think it's probably more of the budget reasons than the cold weather, because Europe gets hot in the summer too. I feel like Paris is definitely on that similar line as Tokyo, where you never know when it'll, randomly have some snow and some colder weather, but in the summer it's still gonna be hot.
Well, Tokyo Disneyland, the Imagineers created a brand new critter country for the park, so the attraction would better fit in with its surroundings. The exterior of this Splash Mountain is similar to the one in California with its lofty Chicopin Hill, but the track layout is different with the loading and unloading of the logs in two different locations, and it's inside the mountain. The interior is closer to the Walt Disney World version, though. The logs were re-engineered to create less of a splash due to the harsher winters and cultural differences. The Tokyo version also houses a two-story counter-service restaurant, Grandma Sarah's Kitchen, deep within the mountain. Tokyo Disneyland Splash Mountain debuted on October 1, 1992. Adding Splash Mountain to the Magic Kingdom presented a few challenges, since, like Tokyo Disneyland, it had no bear or critter country. Unlike Tokyo, there was no space to create a new land either. Here, Splash Mountain had to be a part of Frontierland, and the only available location was next to Big Thunder Mountain Railway. This would require relocating the Frontierland train station and using much of the remaining land that had been originally set aside for the Western River Expedition attraction. Another problem the Imagineers faced was, how do you seamlessly blend the American Southwest of Big Thunder Mountain with the Old South of Splash Mountain, with their vast differences in topography? One way to bring them together was through the use of color. Splash Mountain at the Magic Kingdom uses deeper oranges and reds to complement the nearby desert terrain than the Disneyland version. In addition, the relocated Frontierland train station would serve as a transition between the two attractions, and its architecture blends well with both. Splash Mountain opened at the Magic Kingdom on July 17th, 1992. So do you think they were successful, Craig, in sort of connecting these two different attractions with differences in color and things?
I honestly, really, I never questioned it. It just always felt right. And I know that I experienced Splash Mountain in the first year that it was around. And so, yeah, I was too young to probably really, you know, connect with that on that visual way. But it's just something that I never considered until the Tiana's announcement came around. I never thought of really how different something could look in that area. So I think they did a great job of blending it all together. It's really the rest of Frontierland, that main strip, that just always kind of felt off comparatively. But I also, it's like two different versions of Frontierland. You have the main street of Frontierland that you go down, and then you have kind of the wilderness side of Frontierland further down.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. So now, despite being a guest favorite and often being listed as one of the most popular attractions on guest surveys, the internet and social media finally caught up with Splash Mountain as people rediscovered Song of the South. A controversy over the origin of the attraction's characters and setting began, which soon encompassed the attraction itself, with the storylines of the attraction now keeping alive the memory of the film that Walt Disney Company had been trying to bury for decades. In 2019, an online petition to close Splash Mountain circulated and gathered 14,000 signatures. On June 2020, during the park's closure due to COVID-19, the Walt Disney Company announced that a full renovation and redesign was coming to Splash Mountain, removing the parts that were related to Song of the South, but keeping the track the exact same. They released early designs and concept art that would feature the characters of Princess and the Frog and Disney's first African-American princess, Tiana. The New York Times reported that Disney executives had privately discussed removing the attraction's Song of the South theme for at least 5 years before putting into development a theme based on Princess and the Frog. Additionally, the company announced the song Zippity-Doo-Dah would be removed from their background music in the parks and resorts as, quote, part of a continuous process to deliver an environment that features stories that are relevant and inclusive, unquote. I was surprised about the Zippity-Doo-Dah announcement that they'd be pulling that.
I've watched videos on where they think that the origin of the song came from, and the videos I've seen, it does have a compelling argument to it. And so, like, I understand the connection. Whether or not the average guest understands the connection, that's a different, complete different conversation. It's one of those things that I think that the current management at Disney that's asking these questions and thinking about it, I think they're kind of looking at it with not with the mindset of what is the general masses thinking of what's happening. I think it's very focused on what what if we do something that, you know, is affecting one smaller group or one person, and thinking about those. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. I think that's obviously people should have that mindset and step outside of it. But it's a tough one. I think the attraction as itself with the connections to Song of the South, I think it's easier to erase that versus the people that have kind of looked in and done studies on connecting Zippity Doodah to some of the original music that it was based on. You know, it's not like they all have a point, but it takes a lot of explanation to connect it to. And ultimately it's one of those things where I'm not sure if it necessarily matters. Like, I will sometimes just sit outside and relax and listen to the music loop out front of the train station, especially when I'm walking and I need a little bit of a break to just kind of decompress. And since it being removed, it's one of those things I haven't really ever thought about the fact that it's not in there. So I, you know, we could sit here and go back and forth on whether or not it need to happen, but it ultimately happened. And, you know, that's just the way it kind of is. And I can't say which side of it was right or wrong for it. I just know that it's not one of those things. I haven't missed it being a part of there. It's not, It's not impacted me as a guest, it not being in there. So if it makes other people feel more comfortable, then that's even better, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know about the song's connection to anything. I just thought it was a happy song. it was just delightful.
I think that's the majority of people that probably felt about it, that it just, like, it's this fun song that they knew either from the attraction or from, like, my generation grew up hearing it on the, you know, on
sing-along
songs, mm-hmm. and other, you know, other album releases, hearing it, mm-hmm. you know, it's been covered on, like, when Disney Channel stars would cover songs and they'd release mm-hmm. albums with it. It's not like it wasn't anywhere. Zippity Doodah was all over the place in the 90s and in 2000s. And, like, it was something that everyone knew. But I think it's just, we also live in a different world of social media where people are now getting more context delivered to them. And obviously with that too, there can also be other, you know, I just feel like, we live in such a different time period that the way people get information is more rapidly. And a lot of times you have it delivered only one side of the story. But in this case, you know, I watched and read a lot about it. And I do think that there was issues with how Zippity Doodah was written and delivered and what it kind of means to the overall culture. So it's not something that, like, I'm holding on to, but it's just tough. It's tough. I try to step out of it and say, you know, for people who take the time to learn more about this stuff and read into it, if it makes them uncomfortable, should there be an environment where they walk into a theme park and they don't feel like they can get behind it? And that's something I wouldn't want. Disney is supposed to be a place that everyone can enjoy, mm-hmm. but it's tough because it takes a lot of digging to get to this stuff. I think sometimes in the Disney realm, we can be like, well, it's all over Twitter, it's all over Instagram, it's all over this place or that place. But just because we're in it doesn't mean that the regular person is, that just comes once every couple of years, that doesn't live this and eat and breathe and drink it every day. Mm-hmm. So I don't envy the people that have to make these decisions. If I have
no, neither do I.
Enough. It's because too much to think about.
You're going to anger someone.
Yeah.
When you make these decisions. So
no one is ever going to walk out happy. And the thing is, when the decision's made, you also, it looks really bad if you reverse it on mm-hmm. either side. It's if the mad side ends up being disappointed later, they're going to let you know, and vice versa. It's just, it's a no-win scenario that really kind of stinks.
Yeah. Well, the announcement of this retheming was met with mixed reactions. Some argued that the Disneyland setting alongside New Orleans Square would be perfect for such a transition, but it would be out of place in Magic Kingdom's Frontierland. The project named Tiana's Bayou Adventure is led by Walt Disney Imagineer Senior Creative Producer Trita Carter, with Tony Baxter returning as a creative advisor, although I've been hearing rumors that he's no longer a part of that.
I don't know if he was a part of it ever. I don't have any insider information on that, so I don't want to speak out on it that way. I know Charita obviously has spearheaded
it.
She was on the trip that I was a part of with Walt Disney Imagineering going to New Orleans. So Tony Baxter's name wasn't really mentioned in any of that. And I think it was, you know, if anything, he was mentioned along the lines of what can we, you know, reuse that you previously built. But I'm not sure if it was from a standpoint of like story or background or anything like that. Maybe mm-hmm. just technical, but I don't even think that. I think that was just maybe to when they announce that Splash Mountain is closing right away, that's to ease the blow, saying, don't worry, the original guy that created it, he's going to be part of it. And that kind of helped some people, but obviously not everyone.
Yeah, and a spokeswoman said that there are no plans to redesign the attraction at Tokyo Disneyland. So if you're hankering to, ride Splash Mountain, you can head off to Tokyo for that.
Yeah. And I do wonder if that, once the reviews come in for Tiana's Bayou Adventure, I wonder if that will change. I mean, only time will tell at this point, but
yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Because the thing is, they like cute.
Yes.
In the Tokyo, you know, in the Japanese culture, there's a lot of cute little animals, critters in Splash Mountain.
Very true. Very true.
And they like, I think they probably like the Zippity Doodah song. it's upbeat and all that. So
yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so Splash Mountain closed at the Magic Kingdom on January 23rd, 2023, and at Disneyland on May 31st, 2023. And Tiana's Bayou Adventure is expected to open at both parks in 2024.
Yeah, I think that we will probably know the opening date for Walt Disney World. I'm hoping, as of the week that this is released, I'm hoping that just days from now that we know the opening date for that. But Disneyland, I'm still not sure of that one.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was 2025, beginning of 2025.
I mean, somewhere. We're talking, and what because at Walt Disney World, we thought for sure end of 2024 was the best that we were going to get. And with Disneyland closing so much later, it kind of seemed the same way. So now if it opens in that June, July timeframe that everyone's expecting for Walt Disney World, then maybe it's still on track for a December opening for Disneyland. But that also feels weird too. Like, who wants to open a water ride, especially Disneyland's, where you get soaked on that attraction? Who wants to open that in December or January or February? Like, that's just hold off until like March or April or May when things start to get a little warmer.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. So we shall see. So, there's some talk about, aren't they, like, they're going to extend sort of the New Orleans theme in the Frontierland at the Magic Kingdom? Are those just rumors or?
It's 50-50, because they have said that they are going to have announcements for Frontierland coming in the future. And, you know, there has been plenty of sightings and spottings of Imagineers around Pecos Bill, Tall Tale Inn and Cafe, which is the closest thing you can get to what will be Tiana's Bayou Adventure when it opens. It's right there. So that makes the most sense for a Tiana's Palace restaurant if they go that route. And then they've been testing the beignets at the Golden Oak Outpost, which is right across the street as well. So I think it's coming, but the only thing that makes me not nervous, but kind of questioning that is, they should have gotten started on this well before the attraction was opening if they all wanted it to kind of seamlessly go together. And I have heard a couple things with Country Bear Jamboree that that's supposed to open sometime in the summer, like kind of in that late June, July timeframe as well, too. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a big opening period for all that stuff. And the issue there is that the Pecos Bill Tall Tale Inn and Cafe, it's literally part of the exit for Country Bear Jamboree. So that really complicates things, where if it was going to turn over into a new restaurant, right now would have been the time to do it. Close that entire building and do everything that you need to. So I think it's still going to change one day, but I don't think it's going to be as quickly as we thought, because right now would be the peak time, because once Country Bear Jamboree reopens, then they're going to have to put up extra walls to kind of section it off and keep it away from people's view if they're redoing Pecos Bill. So it's all a little bit confusing, but you know what? So are the way that Disney parks work with budgets and refurbishments and updates. I will never understand it. And I've been doing this now for over 10 years.
Well, even though the content of Splash Mountain is controversial due to its connection with Song of the South, it cannot be denied that this attraction was groundbreaking and has left an indelible mark on the theme park industry. It set a new standard for theme park attractions, and its animal characters and soundtrack have been enjoyed by generations. The closure of the attraction should not erase the work of the many artists, creatives, and Imagineers who worked to create such a beloved attraction. And it is my hope that Tiana's Bayou Adventure will become even more beloved than Splash Mountain. And remember, everybody's got a laughing place. Take the time to find yours. And now it's time for This Week in Disney History. All right. Well, Craig, I think it is my turn to start out. And actually, mine connects to something I mentioned in our history of Splash Mountain. On April 8th, 1973, the Disneyland's Main Street Opera House debuted the Walt Disney Story presented by Gulf Oil. And they had a special guest, Mrs. Lillian Disney Truins, because she did get remarried after Walt died. I think her second husband was a dentist. Anyway, so what this was is it was a biography of Walt Disney's life, and it was a 23-minute film, and it included footage that was rare at the time. And it's narrated by Walt himself from interview recordings. So this is sort of a precursor to the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco, where the whole museum is narrated by Walt and is filled with all kinds of rare footage and artifacts. Also displayed were photographs from the family archives, a collection of memorabilia, and national and international awards presented to Walt over his lifetime. Of course, those are now all in the lobby of the Walt Disney Family Museum. So this replaced Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. And it was sort of controversial, replacing Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. After a couple of years, it switched back. And it was in the lobby of the of Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln for many, many years, decades. So the shows were later combined into one attraction. For a while, what happened is you would watch the Walt Disney Story, and then it introduced Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, and then the Walt Disney Story was moved to the lobby area.
Anyway. I honestly think I would welcome back something like this. I know they, for the 50th anniversary, they did the Steve Martin little video that still plays in the lobby. And I wouldn't be opposed to a show that was more centered around the creation of Disneyland. And then when it got to like the New York World's Fair period said like, and then one of the attractions was Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. And then that cut to Mr. Lincoln still being part of it and showing that, but then going towards Disneyland in the future. Like I wouldn't be opposed to a show that was kind of like that. I feel like that's still needed, especially at Disneyland. There's so much history in that park.
I agree with you. You guys have that wonderful, I mean, this huge exhibit at the Disney Hollywood Studios on Walt Disney and the parks and his Imagineers. And then there's this meet and greet in there, which I don't quite understand why it's there. But then we have nothing like that.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because we certainly have the space for it in the, you know, in the lobby of the Opera House, although that's now like a rotating exhibit area. Which is good. I like that. But certainly a part of that could be set aside for a section on Walt or something. And like what you were saying.
Yeah, I agree. And I just, it's one of those things where it kind of feels silly to say it, but you never know when it's someone's first time Disneyland. And if you want to land home with them real quick on the importance of the park outside of the fun that you can have and good food that you can find around or Star Wars or Marvel, whatever connects them. If you want them to understand why it's so important, give them that show that feels like it delivers that story. Make them walk out of that theater and walk right back into Town Square and look up at the firehouse and see the lantern in the window and be like, I get it now. I totally understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a great idea. Yeah.
They need something like that. And I think they also need that too at California Adventure on the opposite side. And I know they always have the one window in Carthay Circle that, you know, gives a little history and stuff from the archives. But I think there too, it's, you know, you kind of had for the longest time, you had the news kids that would pop up and sing about Suitcases and Dreams and Walt Disney in that way. It's both of those parks, even though they were created at different times. If there is a park that should pay tribute to Walt Disney or an area that should pay tribute, it's both of those parks that should just be overloaded with reasons of why they're so important and what they mean to people who visit them every day.
I agree. Absolutely agree. Yeah, I love that show, the little newsboy, the Red Trolley newsboy show. That was a terrific show.
It was. I mean, I'm happy the Five and Dime came back, so you still have that entertainment when they pull up and she's singing. It's always a good time, but I still remember.
They don't pull up in the car anymore. They just sort of walk up. They have stand in the center area where the fountain is. They just sort of have like a permanent, semi-permanent little structure, but I have not seen the car in ages.
I saw the car in one trip since the pandemic. I have seen the car once. They pull up and they got off and then they sing, but maybe that's just a random thing that they'll do every now and then.
It must be now because I haven't seen the car in a long time.
Newsboys
never came back after the pandemic.
Never. I think they got cut before the pandemic even. I think there was a entertainment/ that they did, which that's... It's a shame. I mean, it was like it followed this line. Like my first trip to Disney California Adventure back in 2013, they still had the Fly Girls in.
They were terrific.
Whatchamacallit, that Grizzly area, whatever it was called before
the airfield. Yeah, whatever it was.
Right across from Soarin', the Fly Girls that put on like this 40s, 50s, almost like USO show. That was incredible. And then you had the red car trolley newsboys, and then you had the Five and Dime. It just, the park had so much entertainment that it
in really one little area, in that one little area, it had great entertainment. Yeah.
But I can tell you, I think I figured out a great place for a Walt Disney story over in Disney California Adventure. It would be where my This Day in Disney History takes place. In 2019, Mickey's PhilharMagic opened up over at Disney California Adventure on Hollywood Boulevard. And it's a cute show. And I really appreciate
Mickey's PhilharMagic.
The fact that they updated it too to add Coco in, excellent. Perfect. It's so, so nice. Does it need to be on both coasts? I don't necessarily think so. And could they use that space in Disney California Adventure in a better way? I think they absolutely could. I was so disappointed that I never got to experience Muppet Vision 3D over in that space. But at the same time, I also prefer it to the kind of like awkward in-between period where, you know, they all those sound stages back there were used for nothing. And they used like the one sound stage off to the side of PhilharMagic for the Marvel store for a little bit. And I've had media events in those places. But I don't know. PhilharMagic, the fact that it opened up in there. That was April 10th that it opened there. I forgot to say that part. Mm-hmm. But April 10th of 2019 is when PhilharMagic opened. It's great to add another attraction to Disney California Adventure to add more bodies. But it could be used for something more.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I like Mickey's PhilharMagic. But yeah, somewhere I would like them to put something about Walt and all that. Yeah, yeah. Bring back some of the shows. They did bring back the Streetmosphere people, which was nice.
They did.
Buena Vista Street.
And we talked about that on a recent Walt Disney World show, that when questioning why have we still not brought back the trolley show at Magic Kingdom or the Citizens of Main Street or the Citizens of Hollywood, we haven't brought back any of those, but yet Disney California Adventure has all of their Streetmosphere. And yeah. It's frustrating, but I also, two different coasts, two different audiences, and it makes sense.
And I think guests find it frustrating because they see their ticket and annual passes and Magic Key prices going up. And then they think, but yet some of the things they enjoy have been cut. And they can't put it's hard to connect the two.
Well, yeah, because even if these people are making, I don't know what an entertainment performer would make, but even if they're making randomly for some reason $35, $40 an hour, that still is a couple tickets. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not, when you like really break it down, what all they get and paying off attractions and stuff, it seems like putting a performer on a street for 8 hours a day is really nothing in the grand scheme of things. But mm-hmm. I'll never understand it.
And it's what makes Disneyland's, the Disney parks special, are those little things. That's why Walt always wanted music in Disneyland when it opened. Wherever you walked, you wanted live music and all that. And so I think we have it more so at Disneyland than Walt Disney World. But
I worry about it on both coasts, because once you start losing it, it then becomes the normal, and mm-hmm. then the new line of people that step in and take power are no longer, you know, they're not remembering it. It's like, oh, well, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't have this. I remember it when I was a kid, but that's been years and years ago. That's too far gone from there. It needs to be kept up, because that is the stuff that if you forget about it, then you don't add it back in, because eventually then they say, well, we've never had it before. Why would you have it now? It's like, you don't know your history.
Yeah. And we lost a lot of the live music in New Orleans Square. We don't have anywhere near as many groups and performers as we used to there.
But it's, you know, at least there's still a little bit, and maybe you'll still see Red rocking around. So mm-hmm. that's something, right? We all love Red.
Oh, of course. Yes. She needs to have a banjo and start singing or something, or a harmonica.
Oh, that would be perfect.
What do pirates play? What do fantasy pirates play? I don't know.
I think they play the Pirates of Penzance. So.
I love that. I love that that stage performance.
No, it's, I have to restate it, though. Disneyland, you still have it better than we have in Walt Disney World with entertainment. Mm-hmm. Walt Disney World, the fact that you still have the Pearly Band at Disneyland alone, and let alone the fact that Mary Poppins and Bert will come out and have the little dance around in front of the castle. And it's, I will forever be jealous, but you know, that's what makes my trips to Disneyland so special, is mm-hmm. that I always know I have that to walk back into. And I appreciate and love everything I have in Walt Disney World, but I love that there's still so many little differences. I just, with live entertainment, it really does, it sets it apart. And a DJ or just music that doesn't fit the area, that doesn't qualify as entertainment. That's just filler. Like stuff that feels natural for the areas. That's what's so important about Disney parks.
And if you've never been to Disneyland, we've mentioned it before, we have so many characters that are just out and about.
Yeah.
It's really special. Sometimes in Fantasyland, I'm shocked by the number of characters that are just around there and heading down to, you know, that stretch along Small World.
Hours in the morning when they just, they walk around and you'll never know when you're like on the teacups and Alice is on the teacups, but then you look out and Aladdin's just waving and it's like,
and the Mad Hatter, and I've seen the genie and
where else does that happen?
Princesses. I mean, it is terrific. Peter Pan roaming around.
And it's something that we just can't have at Walt Disney World because people don't know how to control themselves while they're here. And that's the beauty of Disneyland, is that there's such a respect for not only the characters, but other guests, that it's, if you, you know, everyone knows when Mickey's about to come out on Town Square area and the other characters are out there. They intersperse throughout the day and you get an idea of who's coming when, and the cast members are more than happy to tell you, but you know, and everyone understands, like, okay, I was here first and we've already kind of created a line and we have that. But at the same time too, it's so civil that then once Mickey comes out, we'll make the line and we'll be happy. Whereas Walt Disney World, it'd just be, how many sides can we swarm in from? And I know that too from our Galaxy's Edge when we added the Mandalorian. It's just swarm fest. And with California Adventure, I'm not saying that doesn't happen too, but I've seen the difference in the way the characters in Galaxy's Edge act with the people around versus ours, is that it's more peaceful. Everyone knows that if they are patient, then they'll have a turn. And I wish we had that at Walt Disney World. And I wish then we could have the entertainment to fill it all in too.
Yeah. Well, someday, maybe. Someday. We'll see. Yeah. So anyway, well, you know, we were talking about Tiana's Bayou Adventure, and this week the poster, the official attraction poster, was revealed, and I had to wait and see it because, you know, we just had April Fool's Day. So I had to wait and say, okay, is this real? Because you know how people are on the internet. And so, I looked at it, and at first I thought, oh, is this Disneyland's poster? Because, I have many things about this. But first, I thought it was Disneyland's poster because they have the picture of Tiana's Palace that we have at Disneyland, which was the old French Market. And then they have what looks like our exterior to Pirates of the Caribbean.
From what I understand, the right building now, we talked about it on our last show, and from what I understand now, apparently they have replaced the riverboat in the final scene of Tiana's Bayou Adventure instead of the, whatever it was called, the zippity-doo-dah lady. They have now made like a mansion, I guess, that maybe characters will be on there. So I believe that's what it's from. I could be wrong. That's just reading Twitter and other sources.
There's a mansion inside a salt mountain or whatever it is?
I guess so.
I
mean, it's just as believable as a riverboat happening to be inside a mountain in that way. So I guess that's what it's from, which I could see, like, at the very end, you know, that might be Tiana's house and whatever residents, and her and Naveen and Ralphie and all them are playing and waving at people as they go by. I'm not sure if that's the case, but that's one thing that I read. And then for Tiana's Palace, I think it's the future to come, that one day they'll probably announce that for Frontierland. But
that would make sense,
because it does feel like a blend between. It feels like it's more of a Disneyland poster than it is Walt Disney World.
Right. That's what I thought it was. For me, the thing is, the yellow hurts my eyes. Literally, there's so much yellow.
Yeah, it's bright.
I thought it's interesting color choice. And everything just, I don't know, it's the colors seem to blend in with each other. But I am not an artist, and I don't have an artist's eye the way you do, Craig. So what are your thoughts? Well, you're an artist through your video creations and all that stuff. You have an eye for these kinds of things. So what do you think?
They're doing a couple things right with it. The yellow does pop, and yellow is a color that responds to happiness. So I understand that too. The symmetry on the poster is pretty fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels very uniform. So that's something they're going for. My issues with it is, like many people, the Tiana on it feels a little bit cartoonish versus what we're going to expect. And also, like, the whole thing is, this is the first time she's wearing her, like, full adventurer's outfit, and I don't feel like it doesn't really represent on this poster in that same way. I mean, it's always able to change, but it doesn't, I don't get that same vibe from it. And then it feels like they're leaving, even though they have like the outlined versions of the characters, not silhouettes, outlines. It still feels like they're leaving a lot of negative space open. But ultimately, with the posters, I feel like the bigger problem with Disney parks and the posters isn't like they're releasing this for marketing. Yes, one day it'll be under the train station and we'll see it. It's great. I'm so happy that it will exist. My problem more is there's no uniform design to it, where like with Disneyland, you can look at the posters and you can see when they were created by the different eras. And the same thing even goes with Walt Disney World and to an extent the other parks, because, you know, they've been releasing the calendars of the Disney parks posters, over the last couple of years. And they've even put out the book that was the poster arts from the Disney parks. So it's not like they're inaccessible to see. You can kind of see how it all flows. But I think about it from the perspective of the last big attractions that they've had were Galaxy's Edge. And those posters were all designed to look like Star Wars posters. And then after that, Walt Disney World. I don't even think we got an attraction poster for Runaway Railway, but Disneyland did. And it looked like kind of a Jeff Granito style and like very colorful, very whimsical, just like it kind of fit that attraction. And this Tiana's Bayou Adventure one now, it's a complete different design. So you can't really connect the eras together, even though all of these attractions are coming out within 4 to 5 years of each other. They all look so wildly different from the poster. So that's where my main complaint is. Like, keep it connected. Be like, this is how we're embracing the late 2010s and early 2020s, and this is the look that we're going for. It seems very scattered.
Yeah, to me, it's just there's too much yellows. I mean, it's just like the whole background is yellow. Then there's a lot, there's like golden yellow of the mountain or what, Salt Lick or whatever it is. And then Tiana's wearing a yellow blouse. And then the only other really strong color that jumps out, it's all variations of green. And I don't know, I just don't find it really appealing.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure what the purpose was. Like, I understand when they released the Country Bear, the updated poster for what the new show will be. Well, there was a classic poster with Country Bear Jamboree. There was a classic poster with Splash Mountain, and makes sense to release this along with it for Tiana's Bayou Adventure. But it's one of those things that, like, are they going to sell prints of it? Like, what do they need to make poster art for these attractions anymore? I mean, it still does happen under the railroad station, but I don't know. Maybe it's one of those things that they need to phase out eventually of making new posters for these attractions. Cause I don't feel like they need posters.
I like them. I like having the posters. And, you know, I tried to think of this as, I tried to think of it as with some of the Fantasyland posters, like, you know, where they have the characters in them, like Alice in Wonderland and all that. It doesn't quite, you know.
I would love it. I just don't think they're being utilized. Like, I think they're just kind of making posters for the sake of making posters, because that's what they've always done, rather than thinking about it of like, how do you get people excited for it? The same way when they develop movie posters, sometimes a movie and your interest in it can be either piqued by, the promise of the poster, or it can be like, well, I'm not really feeling this based on what I'm seeing from this. And I don't like that the villain's so big. So clearly they're going to have a big part of it. Like, I don't know. I just don't know if they're being utilized the way that would better suit the purpose of them overall.
Yeah.
And if they're not being used well, then what's the point of having them to begin with?
Yeah, I think they're used mainly for the train station, the tunnels. Remember, Disneyland used to be on the outside gate, you know, the fence.
Which, why can't we get that back?
Yeah, around the, yeah, I don't know why they removed them from that. But maybe for photo, because, you know, it was around the Mickey flower head. You know, they were all around there because Walt wanted to show people what was in the park, because
and
nobody
that's
knew
what they should go back to.
Yeah, because nobody knew what was Disneyland. So these were like movie theater posters for the park to show what was coming up.
Think about how much people would get a kick out of the fact when they go through like a year where they're like, we're only doing retro posters all mm-hmm. back in the place that they originally were. I mean, people would lose their minds over that yeah. stuff. Simple well, they little did additions.
That, they did something like that for Saving Mr. Banks.
Exactly.
They rehung the posters.
Yeah. So, and I mean, they were fine for the film, but in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I agree with you. I think it would be fun. Now, if they want to leave a space so that you can stand in front of the Mickey head in the Disneyland train station, that's fine. But put the posters on, you know, the rest of the fence.
Yeah. I'm okay with them. Yeah. They have that one little space right in front of the Mickey head that's still left open for those perfect photo pass photos. But at the same time, having the posters all the way around showing you what you're about to see, it also is a perfect time capsule of what era you're visiting in based mm-hmm. on what are the posters that they're most eager to push. And mm-hmm. I like that too. That's part of the fun, is that then you can look back and see photos of like, I remember when I was there at that time and I was yeah. there at that time. And
yeah,
who doesn't take a photo out front of the train station?
Yeah, that would be fun. They also hang them, you know, when we have to take the walkways behind Main Street when mm-hmm. it's crowded, they hang the posters along there as well.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
And that's it. So you only see them once in a while.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So, there was an announcement this week. Our Utopia at some point in time, who knows when, is going to be electrified, which means all the rumors about that area, that the submarines and Utopia were going to go away to make room for name in a land, Arendelle, Avatar, whatever was popular, you know, over the years, was going to go in there. Sounds like they're investing in that area of the park. They already did with the submarines and they're keeping them maintained. Yeah. Now they're going to invest in Utopia. I'm sure Tesla is not going to be a sponsor.
No.
If people know, listen to the news. So it's interesting. I think this is long time in coming. As long as they have the technology, the proper technology to make it happen.
Yeah. I'm more on the side where I think it's going to be a hybrid type style. Mm-hmm. I know some people are saying electric in that way. And I'm just, you know, maybe they already have a relationship with Chevy, with Test Track. So maybe they work with their technology. There's plenty of car companies out there who have a firm foot in electric, but it's expensive. It requires charging. So mm-hmm. that's where I could see it being more of a hybrid system, maybe to help, because they said they're looking for a way to electrify and they want to get away from it. As you pointed out, we don't know how long that could take. The next step might be hybrid, and then after that, it's electric. But they can't go the way of just doing electric rails, because that would mean the rails are a bus bar, and that's very dangerous. That's how people die very quickly when they're electrocuted. Right. So it has to be the cars that are electrified, and it's a long process to get to that point. And it's definitely not going to be with Tesla, because based on what Bob Iger said on his CNBC or CNBC segment this morning, he doesn't even listen to the noise from people like Elon Musk and, well, you know, Elon's not super happy with him. So that's
Elon's had a few choice words for Bob Iger,
to say the least. And so I'm excited that it has a future because Tomorrowland Speedway can die tomorrow. Don't care about it. Don't get rid of it. Autopia, it should have a future in Disneyland. It is such a fun ride around that park that is different from anything you get with any other car attraction I've ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. It grew on me ever since we had Bob Gurr on, you know, any years ago, and he talked about this is the one attraction children can control and drive and ride. And he won me over because I was all for, you know, bulldozing it along with the rest of Tomorrowland, except for the submarines. And then he converted me, but I don't ride it because of the fumes. And also because it hurts my leg to push so hard on the gas. And so I hope that's something that the new cars will.
It's not correct. Great. Me, though, it's a must do. I do it every time. And I just get a kick of it. I think that little portions where you go off road for a second and you're just like kind of lost driving through the trees. It's so, so special. It's so unique.
I agree with you. Absolutely. And I'm going to start doing it more. And I think Honda sponsors it out here. And Honda's, I know, putting more into their EVs and stuff. So who knows? Maybe they will have a solution for this. I know I've heard about charging plates being used. And I don't know. I don't know what it is. But I mean, Disneyland will have to look at like their electrical grid. I mean, they're going to have to make all kinds of changes.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot. I have a Honda hybrid and I get like 55 miles per every gallon of gas. So it's not bad. They're not a bad company for it.
Yeah. So, and then speaking of news, we haven't really talked about it, but what's your take on everything that went down with this whole Nelson Peltz and the whole Disney board of directors battle? And well, the vote was earlier this week and Nelson Peltz and his team didn't make it on there. It was the first time I was really interested in voting as a shareholder with my, you know, my little 5 shares that I have or whatever.
Yeah.
But I thought, oh, this is sort of fun this time. I took interest in what was going on. What were your thoughts on the whole thing?
The main thing that I believe with it is that I actually think there was a solid case for Peltz to get on the board, as well as Rizzullo, which Rizzullo struggled even more. I think they said his was like, it was 1-7 votes for him. So he had like no chance. Peltz was like 1-3. So a little bit better, but still not enough. I don't like using the terminology necessarily of echo chambers, but you have to also acknowledge, too, that when it's this board that's comprised of all these people that Disney wants, all these people in this place, that they are essentially building a form of an echo chamber in that way of just being there to make decisions based on what Bob Iger wants. So I totally get trying to disrupt that a little bit and saying, what if we had someone with a dissenting opinion who's going to basically disagree with every single thing that comes in there? Now, if Peltz and Rizzullo would have had enough power to do what some people said that they were planning on doing, is getting in and breaking up all parts of the company and getting enough of the other board members to agree on selling stuff and destroying the company, then absolutely you don't want someone on like that. But I am all for the idea of get someone in with an outside perspective who is looking at things in a fresh way. And I'm not sure if Disney as a company does a good enough job necessarily at thinking about that sometimes. It doesn't, especially in positions where it doesn't have to hurt, because ultimately the board still has to vote and they have to get a certain number of votes to win out. And if Peltz was ever to take a position on the board, would he ever be able to sway enough people? Probably not. But is it also valuable to have that one person who's saying, maybe we don't do this? I think absolutely. You know, had he been on the board before the entire JPEG situation happened, maybe that wouldn't have happened, where everyone just said, yep, we'll vote on this guy because Bob Iger is telling us. Maybe you avoid situations like that, but you know, there's no sense in not having an outside voice. So Disney obviously wanted it to go the way they did, and I am happy that they got that, but I'm also not necessarily against having someone that is looking at it from more of a business perspective versus just saying, well, the people who are in charge, should we just give full trust into them? Sure, go ahead. Let them do it. But
yeah, I sort of think along the same line you are. And I thought, yeah, maybe a fresh set of eyes in there to question it. Maybe not a yes person, you know, mm-hmm. for Bob Iger.
Exactly.
In there, especially because the company has been struggling. You know, whatever Bob Iger that may say, they're financially not doing well right now. And no. they need to change course some way. Yeah.
Yes. And the hard part with this one is that the first time around when Peltz made his argument for being on the board when JPEG was still in power, it was very park centric and what can we do to change around the parks and get back to what they used to be. And I thought that was a compelling argument that he had a good standpoint on. And he kind of like, he interests me in those moments. This time around, switching gears to the studio side, and you know, Ike Perlmutter, who hates Bob Iger for losing a job, like that definitely got in his ear. And so his entire speaking point of, do we really need all black casts or all female casts? I thought that was completely missing the mark. And I wouldn't be surprised if that hurt him.
I think it did.
Yeah, I think the first, and ultimately the other thing too that I don't think Disney expected is that they flat out said that the day traders, basically the normal people who own stocks, actually voted in abundance, which, you know, it's the day traders and people that own one or two or five stocks, like you said, they don't own enough to like outweigh the mutual funds that invest heavily, but they still had enough voted to make a difference. So that's an interesting thing to look at it too. But I do think Disney would benefit by having someone on the outside questioning this stuff. And that's why I gave JPEG a lot of credit as he stepped in, that while he was part of the company for many, many years, the way he approached the business felt like an outsider. It felt like someone who wasn't brainwashed by Disney, enjoyed the company, loved what it gave him, but he wasn't attached to it in such a strong way. But as for the person in charge, it proved to not be the right method, but I don't know if that's not the right method in terms of the board.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how they move forward. So.
Yeah. Best of luck on their next endeavor of finding a successor for Bob Iger.
Well, hopefully they're more successful this time around.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I used several references in working on this episode, including the book Who's Afraid of the Song of the South and Other Forbidden Disney Stories by our late friend Jim Corcus. I always think, you know, if he had lived, how many more books were still in him? Yeah.
I know.
The Complete History of Splash Mountain at Disney Parks by Tom Corliss, of some websites and articles, including that one. A Brief History of Disney, Splash Mountain by our own Zoe Wood, here at WDWinfo.com. Mm. The Iconic Legacy of Splash Mountain by Dom at Mickey Central. The Disney Wiki's entry on Splash Mountain. From Bear Country to Critter Country, Disney's Opening of Splash Mountain for the Disney Classics site. The Complicated History of Disneyland Splash Mountain and Song of the South by Dirk Libby for Cinema Blend. A Brief and Incomplete History of Splash Mountain for WDWmagic.com. The Story of Brer Critters by Sasha Coles for the Enchanted Archives. And in the New Georgia Encyclopedia, their entry on Joel Chandler Harris. And The Wild History of Splash Mountain by C.Z. Anderson. Also an interesting video on the theme park history of Splash Mountain. So Craig will include links to these resources in our episode description. So Craig, until next time, how can our listeners connect with you?
As always, you can find me on social media at Teleclaster. You can find me on the different shows I'm on the Diz Unlimited podcast network. And you can find me by email, craig@disneyinfo.com. What about you, Michael?
You can send me messages at michaelbowling@disneyinfo.com, ex-Twitter. What did I say it was going to be? Twitter X? Twittix?
Twittix.
Twittix. I should copyright that. At mbowling121. Facebook, Michael Bowling - Connecting with Walt. Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. And you can connect with me and Craig on Twitter at Connecting Walt. If you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes on the link Craig includes in our episode description. Look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Pandora, and Amazon podcasts, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings when possible. So thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother, Roy.